And I knew when I did that, at least one more person would walk through the door, because that's sort of how it works. So, let me just briefly tell you what our agenda is going to be today. We are going to have some conversation about the LC4258, which is the rough draft of the prospective piece, which we discussed in concept form last week. I will tell you that at 4 o'clock, the committee is going to have to take a brief recess for purposes of two of us are on the Legislative Council Committee, which is having to gavel in for about a 5-minute meeting to conduct some business, and then we'll come right back. And then we will continue our discussion on LC4258. The purpose is really going to be for the committee to dialogue a little bit about the draft and ask questions, as well as to allow anybody in the audience or participants to come forward and give us sort of their initial comments. I want to give a word of just warning about the draft. You'll notice that it says rough draft to LC4258. This is a rough draft document. It is still a working document, so the tendency in these situations is the moment someone sees something in LC form, their knees start to shake and quiver, and they get all nervous that decisions have been made to which they have not been included or a part of, and that is not at all what's happening here. What is happening here is recognizing the time constraints of the session. I'm in a position where I've got to start putting things in LC format so we can start trying to get something together that will represent or at least appear to look like a bill at some point for this committee to review. And that means moving from concept form to LC form as we start wordsmithing this. And that's what we're doing in LC4258. You know, it's open to all sorts of further discussion and will be certainly amended. As I've gone through it, and we just got it out of LC today, and as I've gone through it, I've seen things in it that are even different than I thought they were going to be based on our conversation last week and what I thought I had asked for. So I'm as subject to my concerns about some of the wording in this version as you are. That's why we do this in committee and we have a big, long conversation about it and everybody gets to talk. So I just want to put that up front so we don't all high center on particular verbiage at this point. The other thing we want to do is we want to start by giving former legislator Hector McPherson an opportunity to address the committee, and we're going to do that now, and then hopefully we'll recess briefly and then come back in again to talk more about the issue. So please, Mr. McPherson, if you'd come forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Likely, I'm flattered that this many of you are here if the session is still going on up there. So thank you that are here, and I have written out the essential parts of my testimony so that they all can have the advantage of that. Good afternoon. I'm Hector McPherson, and the chief sponsor of both Senate Bill 100 and Senate Bill 101 in the 1973 session. And I thought it would be helpful to this committee to hear firsthand the discussions of the fairness issue that preceded the introduction of these two bills. Senate Bill 100, the headline bill, created the framework for the Oregon system. It did not in itself bring up the takings issue. It would be the actions of the Land Conservation and Development Commission that would bring about a reduction in property values. However, we are aware of the issue. We were aware of the issue and that it had been litigated in the federal courts and that there were limits to the degree of regulation that could be imposed. I had secured a copy of the book entitled Windfalls and Wipeouts that went extensively into the issue. The Senate Bill 101, the companion bill that dealt directly with the fairness issue. Now, this is the bill that provided the legislative justification for placing most of Oregon's farmland into the exclusive farm use zones, thus limiting the opportunities for development. In the words of the law, ORS 215-243, exclusive land use zoning, as provided by law, substantially limits alternatives to the use of rural land, and the importance of rural lands to the public justifies incentives and privileges offered to encourage owners of rural lands to hold such lands in exclusive farm use zones. Then it went on to list the incentives and privileges that should be, there should be. There were three tax reduction measures proposed. One, the special assessment of farmland required a change from assessing it on the fair market value to assessing on a computed farm use value. This reduced property taxes on farmland from 50% to 80%. Two, inheritance taxes were based on farm use value rather than market value. Third, the taxes levied by sewer and water districts were not to be applied to land zoned exclusively for farm use. The bill also included Oregon's first right to farm provisions and tied them to the EFU provisions. It restricted the ability of local governments to put unreasonable restrictions on accepted farming practices in EFU zones. This is the bill that made EFU zoning acceptable to farmers and eventually made the Oregon Farm Bureau a believer in farmland preservation. Now, I should divert a little bit from my testimony here to point out that there was a downside to this. And what's happened, because we had created all these incentives in there, we had people that in the original zoning that took place following the passage of Senate Bill 100, that instead of opting for rural residential land, even though they were in an area that might have qualified for that, they opted for the EFU designation. And county commissioners have been unhappy ever since with the fact that they had land that they considered not farmable that was in the EFU zone, and therefore it was the EFU's kinds of restrictions that applied. But anyway, that's what we did. We made it clear as we could that it was good for farmers and that this was the thing that brought them on into the program. Rather than kicking and screaming, they came in happy. But they've forgotten about that now. You'll find a lot of them think, well, gee, this is just the way it always has been, and they should therefore accede to this, and they want out when it's time for them to get out. But there is more to the story than the simple story of its passage. This was a drama in bipartisan appeal and the individuals involved. Senate Bill 101 was co-sponsored by Senate Bill Tony Meeker, who became state treasurer. On introduction, it was assigned to the Revenue Committee chaired by Democrat Vern Cook. It was then given to a subcommittee of the Revenue Committee chaired by Vic Attia, who did the final polishing of the bill. And it came to the floor vote without the inheritance tax provision at the insistence of Democrat Vern Cook. On the floor, Mike Thorne, Democrat Pendleton, and Bob Smith, Republican Burns, voted against Senate Bill 101 because the Senate Revenue Committee had deleted the estate tax benefits. Now, I'm sure that you really know who these are, but let me just refresh your memory that Mike Thorne was longtime chairman of Ways and Means here and went on to become the executive director of the Port of Portland. And in fact, he's even rumored as being a possible candidate for governor this next time. And Bob Smith, of course, went on to become Congressman Bob Smith, and both of them were on the other side. Now, Senator Thorne, he had been on the committee that actually brought Senate Bill 100 through. Senator Thorne had explicitly linked Senate Bill 101 to the zoning contemplated at Senate Bill 100 and said that without the estate tax goodie, Senate Bill 101's tax benefits were not adequate. He moved for reconsideration, was successful, and had Senate Bill 101 sent to the Environment and Land Use Committee rather than the Revenue Committee. Now, this was a friendly committee on which Attia, Thorne, and I all served, and Ted Halleck chaired. It came back to the floor on June 9th with the estate tax provision reinstated and passed 25-5. Now, what does this history lesson say about the claim by promoters of Senate Bill of Measure 7 that they are entitled to compensation? They have been compensated in property tax reductions on farmland by what the Department of Revenue has calculated to be $117.7 million in the 99 and 2000 biennium. For all the reductions since 1973, the figure would be well over $1 billion. The reduction in inheritance taxes has never been calculated, nor have the reductions in special service district taxes. Now, I would suggest that Henry Richmond, who's in the room today, you get him in on this topic, because he's looked extensively into the different provisions that were in not only this bill, but in other bills to reduce the taxes on the land that's been zoned for farm and forest uses. Now, if I had been a forester, I probably would have tied this kind of a thing in on taxes, but I wasn't rewriting at that time the forestry taxes, because I think this was tied because I was a farmer and I knew about the problem. This is where it went. This was the bargain struck in 1973. You limit the development on your land, and in return you get a property tax assessment that is in proportion to the land's agricultural potential. To make the bargain clear, Senate Bill 101 provided for a penalty of 10 years of back tax obligation if the use of the land was changed. This is the background that the Oregon Farm Bureau understood when it asked this committee to consider no compensation for regulatory takings for keeping farmland as farmland, but do consider it a fairness issue when government prevents the harvesting of crops or grazing of cattle along streams. Limiting farm uses should be a compensable action. Following the passage of Measure 7, I have been asked about the provisions in Senate Bill 100 that the Joint Legislative Committee study the compensation issue. This was added to the bill in the LBJ compromise. Tom McCall had nothing to do with it. The compromise was hammered out by LBJ, working with Fred Venata of the Home Builders, Ward Armstrong representing AOI, and Gordon Foltz of the Association of Oregon Counties. Senate Bill 100 was signed into law on May 29th of that year. Senate Bill 101 was not debated and voted on until almost a month later. It could not have been known by the LBJ committee that the fairness issue would be addressed there. Now, I was not a party to the discussions of the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use and do not know why they sent their recommendation back for no legislative action. I can assume, however, that they looked at this issue as I did and decided that fairness had been addressed and that no action was necessary. They may have looked at Senate Bill 849, which came to the Senate Environment and Land Use Committee late in the session. Now, it provided that the state of Oregon should bond itself and go into the business of buying development rights. That bill died in committee after McCall's representative testified that it was not needed. Given the history of land use and the fairness issue, there is one direction for this committee to take the problem. Make compensation prospective where it relates to EFU land. This greatly simplifies the issue and makes compensation issues more manageable. That includes my thumbnail history course for you today, and if you've passed 101 on the history of Senate Bill 100 and 101, well, I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Mr. McPherson. We do appreciate you coming back, and it's actually fun to see the names of some of those very same people that are still sort of haunting the halls of this building. That was probably that was long enough ago. Fred Venata probably had hair.
LBJ beat them all down pretty good in that committee.
Yeah, Fred Venata and Ward Armstrong and Gordon Foltz, and I mean that's just fascinating that they've been in this process that long. Are there questions for Mr. McPherson of the committee?
Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck.
Hector, you've talked mostly about the bill with respect to EFU lands, and I think one of the problems we're wrestling with is that a number of landowners who feel entitled to something are people who have been regulated within urban areas by local governments or in rural residential zones, and often those are the people who complain the most, and I'm wondering if you can provide any perspective on how we might want to look at the non-EFU people prospectively as their properties continue to be regulated.
Well, my perception is that you've heard less from the people that are not in EFU that are in the rural residential, because they basically got what they want there, that they got their development, and they're limited, of course, in what they can do. The problem has been that those that are in EFU and still want to convert over to the non-EFU type of legislation. And I think that's, you know, that's a problem, all right, but I think it's a perception. If they look back on the amount of tax reductions they've gotten, they would be
substantial,
better themselves compensated.
Any further questions for Mr. McPherson? Yes, Representative Schrader.
You alluded to the forest issue and not being an expert, perhaps, in that aspect of things. For our committee's sake, who would be the person, perhaps, to talk to, in your opinion, that has some history or more history, if you will, on that particular side of the issue?
Well, I think the forest issue really is an equivalent issue. It's just never been tied directly to the zoning that went on. But I think that foresters recognized, in fact, the Oregon Forest Council and so on has been supportive of land use planning because they recognized that they were getting a return for keeping people out of their particular their area. So, you know, as far as the total tax position is concerned, why, of course, I suppose that Brown, the head of the forestry department, is the person to bring in and discuss that with.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
I'd just like to thank Mr. McPherson for coming, and I really appreciate his perspective and making a special trip down
here. I've
been
around a long time, but as you see, I'm not as young as I used to be, but thank you for having me.
Mr. McPherson, just if you could tell us, I'm just interested, did you serve in both the House and the Senate?
No, I served only in the Senate.
Only in the Senate?
Only one term.
Only in the Senate for one term?
Right.
And it was a monumental term?
It was.
Yeah, a monumental term.
And it was a great deal of cooperation between Republicans and Democrats. And in the session, the 1973 session, was chaired by Democrat Jason Bowe. But everything was divided, and just as I saw in this committee, that the different bills that I was shepherding through, that, you know, they didn't divide up on party lines.
Well, Mr. McPherson, I understand if you go over there while they're in session, they'll let you onto the floor, and they actually give you a free lunch. So I don't know. I don't know if you're interested, but I know I'm going to come back and get my free lunch someday. So
that would be nice.
Yeah, great. All right, we're going to take a moment and recess the committee while Representative Schrader and I run downstairs to convene the Legislative Council Committee for about a five-minute meeting that we have to have. We'll be back up here, and why don't we just make it a time certain at, 4:10 or 4:15? Why don't we make it a time certain at 4:15? We'll reconvene the committee at then. Until then, we're in recess. Members want to go on the floor and vote on some bills, you can. This meeting got scheduled sort of at the last minute on top of this meeting, and both Representative Schrader and I are needed in that meeting briefly. So we'll be in recess for about 15 minutes. It's just that time of the session. We have before us LC Draft 4258, which, as I explained, is a very rough draft version of the concepts that were put forward in the concept document last week. I'm not sure it's necessarily helpful to have council go through it again in a section-by-section way, since it generally falls along those same guidelines. But I would want to give the committee an opportunity to have some discussion or ask questions about the draft, if they have any. Otherwise, I'm going to ask folks to come forward, anybody here who wants to make a brief comment and share with us some of their comments about the concept or the draft, recognizing that all of us, I think, received the draft sometime around noon or after today. So it's not as after one. Okay, well, and this will not be the only time for people to speak to this issue. So if you don't feel like you're ready to comment, you don't have to. You know, we'll find another opportunity at a later hearing to bring people forward to comment, but also I think we want to receive any comments people have currently if they want to share them. So with that, I'll open it up to the committee. Are there comments from the committee or discussions or questions of council while we have it in front of us? Okay. Well, and I understand. I mean, I didn't get handed it, the draft until today as well, so I recognize we're all in the same boat. What about members who are, or folks who are here in the audience? Mr. Tucker, you want to come up and share a few comments with us?
Thanks, Randy.
That was graceful. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, 1000 Friends of Oregon. I actually do have some written testimony that is longer than it needs to be, especially given the fact that I haven't had a chance to look through the LC draft. This is just based on the concepts, knowing from last week's hearing that the concepts themselves were, you know, not cast in stone.
Work in process.
Neither is this. But let me just run through. Well, actually, let me hand this in before I do that, so you can look at it if you want. Thank you. And as I've said before, we appreciate the committee's efforts to find ways of addressing the concerns about fairness to property owners while still recognizing the need of other property owners and communities to guide the use of land in ways to protect our quality of life in Oregon over the long term. This is just an initial response, as I said. And let me just, I do have a little bit in here about what we consider the first priority, which is has not been, you have not released any kinds of drafts on yet, which is addressing the concerns of rural landowners, individual rural landowners, for regulations that have been applied in the past. The one comment I'd like to make on that front is just a response to a discussion that you had last week about conservation easements and the idea that when somebody is compensated, and this would apply, I think, prospectively as well, when somebody is compensated, that state or the local government who is doing the compensating receives something in return, and I think the discussion last week was about conservation easements or deed restrictions. And I just want to point your attention to the footnote in my testimony on page one where I address that question. Basically, the idea is, and my understanding is, that if we are paying somebody to comply with a particular regulation, then it seems reasonable that there be some sort of something in the title of that property so that what has been paid for by the public remains something that the public has, whether it is paying somebody in exchange for their ability to build a house on a piece of property or whatever it might be. We don't want to be paying people and then having that regulation go away and having the property developed in the way that the regulation was trying to prevent in the first place. So that was, I just wanted to address that issue that was raised last week. With respect to compensation for new regulations, our main concern is that our communities maintain the ability to respond to the challenges of growth in the future. And as our population grows and other circumstances change, both the state and local governments need to be able to take reasonable steps to protect their citizens' quality of life. Obviously, we can't offer a definitive response on the concept released last week in the absence of certain information. One is the percentage reduction in value that creates the entitlement to some form of payment. I understand, I haven't actually looked through today's draft, I understand there's a number in there, but I'm not going to comment on that number quite yet. Second, how the reduction in value would be calculated, and third, administrative costs associated with this process. Because, as I've previously testified, we believe Measure 7 was about fairness, and fairness may involve factors other than losses of property value. We're somewhat skeptical of the wisdom of simply relying on a percentage threshold that operates as an entitlement to compensation. This is especially true for retroactive claims. This may or may not be, for prospective claims, this may or may not be a workable solution, but we definitely believe more information is needed before we can answer that question. We also think that the voters intended to address issues of fairness for individuals. As we previously testified, the focus of any new compensation scheme ought to be on average citizens who may suffer losses of property value due to regulations rather than on reasonable regulations governing commercial and industrial activities. If compensation for prospective regulations is to be determined based on a percentage threshold for reductions in value, it's critical that the percentage threshold not be set too low. Otherwise, it will become impossible for local governments to adopt new regulations. Such regulations might be needed to protect overall quality of life or to protect the interests of landowners whose property values may be reduced by neighboring development. If the threshold is set too low, either there won't be enough money to make the payments or there will be so many variances that the new law or regulation won't be effective in the first place. And again, we urge you to take a look potentially at some past regulations that have been adopted in Oregon and what kinds of impacts they may have had on property value in order to give us a sense of what threshold might be appropriate. Do the kinds of research that that will help us to come up with a number with some data behind it. Second, on the issue of how we calculate reductions in value, the report that we commissioned last fall during the campaign from Eco Northwest showed how different approaches to calculating losses in property value could yield dramatically different amounts of money needed for paying landowners. The example that I'd like to provide is the regulation against placing cell towers in residential neighborhoods in Salem. The study that we released indicated that over the life of a cell tower, the net present value to a landowner could be about $100,000 in payments from the company. But if we take a before and after test instead, what's the value of the property before the regulation went into effect and after, the net effect might be negligible, or it might even enhance the value of that property. So the valuation test that we use should be based on the best calculation of the actual effects of the regulation on the value of property. Second, reductions in value need to take into account increases in value, or calculations of reductions in value need to take into account any increases that are caused by changes in government regulation during the period that the claimant owned the property. And we've mentioned this before in previous testimony, so I won't belabor the point. Third, the concept draft from last week did not address the need to consider losses in property value when regulations are eased or waived or eliminated on neighboring properties. And this is an element that we think should be included in a response to Measure 7. I'd like to raise another problem, which is the cost of administration. Again, I'm not going to read you the testimony here, but I believe in the concept draft there is a state fund for administering the program. Maybe it wasn't written down. Maybe it's from a conversation that I've had with one of you. But we certainly believe it's important to provide funding for administration of this process. Without it, the chilling effect of the process, just the administrative costs, may discourage especially smaller communities from enacting regulations in the future that may be needed to address changed circumstances. And I will conclude with one or two more quick comments. We appreciate the fact that the concept draft passed out last week indicates that any new rules or ordinances that are needed to implement laws and goals that are in effect before the date of the adoption of this measure, did I say that clearly, are exempt from its provisions. For example, cities and counties are required to periodically update their land use plans and regulations if their current plans and regulations are failing to implement the statewide planning goals that have been in effect for 25 years. So new regulations that are needed to carry out old laws and goals must be exempt. And as I said, it seems that that was in the concept draft. We need to make sure that statutory language adequately accomplishes that goal. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker.
Answer any questions if I can.
Are there questions for Mr. Tucker? We appreciate you providing us your testimony and making your comments. Are there any other persons here who want to come forward and make any comments about the draft in front of us today? Okay. It would be my intent that we will address issues on the draft. I'm not to the point of sort of saying speak now or forever hold your peace, but I'd strongly encourage that by next week's meeting, if people have concept issues they want to talk about in this draft, that they be prepared to address them in front of the committee at next week's meeting. The next thing we're going to do at next week's committee meeting is we're going to move into the concepts on the rural discussion that we were hoping to have this week that we didn't get quite ready in time because of some of the other issues, trying to get this out of legislative council and the like. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be taking sort of a time to overview the rural piece next week, as well as taking some more detailed discussion on the going forward piece. Obviously, members of the committee are available individually to be talked to about any of these issues. I make again available the services of Ginny Gustafson Lucker, our counsel. If you have issues, you want to go sit down with her and ask questions about, so you're understanding at least issues that you don't know whether or not you like or not. Come talk to her, and maybe she can help you understand them, and we can clear some of that stuff up on the record. I'm trying to make this as open and communicative as possible, but we're going to need people to start coming forward and talking about the issues. Representative Schrader.
I think to that point, I'd like to see written comments from anyone that really cares about this process prior to next week's meeting. I don't want to have to see their comments any more than I'd like to see this sort of thing at last minute. The reason we gave out the draft last week is so we get more comments. We've gotten only one comment, and I don't frankly take kindly to only having one comment on such a big issue unless everyone assumes we're doing great work and go forth and whatever we think is fine.
I think they're all on board, Representative Schrader.
That's what I'm gathering also, Mr. Chair. So I'm pleased with that. I didn't realize we were clairvoyant.
Do you want to make a motion?
Yeah, I'm ready to go. So I would hope we'd have written comments from any interest out there or citizen, as that may be, before next week's meeting. I'd look for comments by Monday or Tuesday of next week, probably at the latest.
Representative Schrader's advice would be well taken. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, can you comment on where the lot of record data is in the
process? Yes. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. We are, in fact, I am hopeful that that's another thing we'll do in next Thursday's meeting is take a brief review. Is that, are we going to be there?
Yes. This is my understanding.
Yeah. So we will have a presentation next week from Dan Cooper of Metro, who we've sort of tasked with the responsibility of overseeing the communication with all the counties about pulling this data together. And the people who've been crunching most of the numbers will also be here with us next week. They'll give us an overview of the work that they've done to assemble the data. They will give us an outline of what the data is. I'm not sure we'll be in a position, although I'm hoping we'll be in a position to not only say, here's what the data is, but then here are some conclusions that pretty much everybody in the process of gathering that data can agree that it reflects. I mean, there's sort of three steps there. One is what the data says. The other one is what the data means. I think we'll for sure be at what the data says. I'm not sure we'll be quite to everyone yet agreeing as to what the data means, but I think we're going to have some pretty good ideas. They've done a lot of work, and I wish they were, well, we'll do this a little bit next Thursday, but there are a boatload of people, most of whom remain, to me, sort of nameless out there in the lands who have been doing a lot of work crunching these numbers for us to give us what is still going to be, I think, in a lot of ways, and I think you'll see some of the discrepancies or challenges we're going to face in interpreting this data, but what will still be, I think, for the first time in the history of this discussion, probably the most comprehensive accumulation of data about potentially affected properties that anybody's had a chance to look at. Representative Schrader and then Representative Lowe.
just to elaborate a little bit, I had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Cooper the other day, yesterday, and the list that I understand they're preparing, just so the committee is mentally prepared to look at whatever list comes out, is just a compilation of all properties done by different dates, just to give the committee and the public a snapshot in time, given certain acreages that we're talking about that could, you know, possibly be compensated under either lot of record types of provisions or parcel size types of things, so we can kind of look at that. And I don't think we're supposed to interpret that as any final list of this is all the people we are doing or dealing with. I believe there's an attempt to kind of overlay different zoning regulations, which I understand have changed dramatically in the last 25 years, to who could build at what point in time. So it's kind of, it is a monumental task. And I think it, again, like the chair has said, it's pretty amazing to me what GIS can do nowadays and interested citizens can do wanting to get involved and really leverage their limited resources. But we should be careful how we look at this. And
that'll be part of the presentation next week. What it's going to show us is it's going to show us some snapshots of people who've been in continuous ownership of their property predating 1975 and adoption of, you know, the comprehensive plans and the goals, all the way through 1993 and the change in the lot of record law to year 2000 ownerships. Not all data is collected the same in all counties, and so as a result, we'll have some counties where we've got pretty good data that goes historically reasonably far back. We'll have some other counties where we don't have that data, and you'll get to see sort of the smattering of the counties that we've been working with, which some, you know, we're a little weaker on the east side where the data hasn't been as developed as effectively in computer models where we can pull it forward. But we'll do that next week, and you'll have an opportunity to really evaluate the model. And to the extent that I can get you in advance of next Thursday's meeting an outline of the data so you can look at it with a run of an explanation of how they prepared it, that'll better help you prepare to answer or to ask questions of the folks bringing it forward at next week's meeting. Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would also be useful to try to get some sort of an idea of what the facts and figures would show on these lots of records, given the testimony of Mr. McPherson. I'm wondering to what extent has a benefit accrued to these properties over the time, the benefit that was contemplated in Senate Bill 101. And I don't know how tough it would be to gather that data, but do you suppose we could ask to see at least a sampling of that?
Well, I think there's some people out there who have been doing some research on this issue, unconnected with anything we've been talking about, who might be able to provide some helpful information for us at some point in the process. None of this is ever as easy as one would think it is, and I'm learning that in trying to deal with just the data we've asked for. And I think one of the things this committee is going to have a discussion about is, under any compensation mechanism, you know, what factor does any of the farm deferral play in the evaluation of what the total amount of compensation ought to be? That can be addressed in some ways on a case-by-case basis if necessary. I mean, there are actual records for what people got over a period of time. So, I mean, some of that data is out there. The extent to which we're going to be able to collect it and use it as a point of analysis, I think, is going to be harder to say. But certainly we can make the inquiry.
I would appreciate that.
Yeah.
I think it would be of use.
Okay. Any other comments? Representative Beck.
We've got the prospective piece and the rural piece. What would your counsel be about us thinking about a compensation piece, and what should we be thinking about? So it's very hard for me to really digest all this and without a sense of where we might be headed with a compensation piece. Is there a work group working on that?
By compensation, do you mean?
Well, funding.
Oh, the funding. The revenue generating piece.
Is that a separate piece? I mean, ultimately, these would conceivably be all woven in together, but I kind of
not next week, but I think the week after, Representative Beck. My hope is to bring in Mr. Warner, who is the legislative revenue officer, and to walk the committee through a number of different scenarios.
Okay.
You know, I think the discussion starts with, you know, what are our range of potential options, how would it work, and, you know, what's the nexus relationship to the issue we're trying to solve, And we'll go through each of those options, and then we may pick a few as a committee to explore in more detail.
Do you want to do that as a separate component rather than integrating it to these two pieces? I don't care. I'm just...
Yeah, I think it just... And in the end, I think there's going to have to be an overlay of integration, but the only way I can figure to roll these out is sort of component by component, so we've got pieces to sort of chew on at a time. And that one's obviously going to be a big one, and, you know, it's going to take us some time to probably work through it. But that's sort of what I'm anticipating probably 2 weeks from today. And I'll tell you, committee, I mean, on the one hand, there's a ton to be worked on here. On another hand, when we have these meetings, it doesn't seem like we can get anybody to come up and talk to us. So my intent right now is to just have another meeting next Thursday and to stick with that schedule. There will be a point when we're going to have to start working the bill as we tie it all together in a work session format. And, you know, that just may end up being, you know, we'll just get ourselves adjourned and work for 3 days. And
faint reminder of the VAT tax.
Well, I hope better than that, Representative Pack. Is there any further comments before the committee? Anybody else who wishes to be heard? Don, you want to come up and say something?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau, caught my attention talking about farm use assessment. Farm use assessment is not compensation, was not compensation. We had farm use assessment prior to land use planning. All we got out of land use planning was that you didn't have to file the papers to get farm use assessment when you were inside the EFU zone. That was the only thing we got out of that. We had farm use assessment before that. Farm use assessment is nothing more than using the income approach to determine the value of the property, the same as they do with commercial and industrial property. So we do not see that as compensation.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Anybody else? All right. Well, this has been less than fully instructive, but we appreciate you coming anyway. Mostly, we appreciate Mr. McPherson. He was the only one that was really instructive. But thank you very much, and we'll adjourn the committee.
You're instructive. Don't worry. No, don't worry. Well, I have to go back after that. That turned into a